This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
Everybody, we're going to stay with the jobs report. As we said, the number coming in, certainly non-farm payroll, softer than forecast. The unemployment rate coming in as forecast, but we did see an uptick when it comes to average hourly earnings and also average weekly hours worked. So let's get to it and see what our roundtable has to say. Matt, Yelena Shiletyeva, senior U.S. economist at BNP Paribas, she joins us in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker studio, along with our Steve Matthews, economics reporter at Bloomberg News. He's out there in our Atlanta Bureau. Steve, Yelena, happy Friday. Yelena, great to see you back here at Bloomberg headquarters. So talk to us about the report. Let's go through today before we start looking forward. How did you assess the numbers that we got today?
Well, this was a classic example of don't change your forecast on ADP, right? So that's the first thing that comes
so
to mind.
It was so off. Right?
Yeah, they were off. They track, things differently. But this report is telling us that things are slowing down. They continue to slow down. That nothing is urgent. Recession is not imminent. But at the same time, there were signs of weakness in this report. And Matt, you listed a lot of good things. Let me tell you, there were a few weak things in there as well. So
what was the weakest thing? I mean, if you look, Carol is talking about temporary work, which I agree. If you look at that chart, it's no bueno. But what did you focus on?
In addition to that, you should look at aggregate hours worked for the second quarter in aggregate. So if you look at that, you see that aggregate hours worked only grew 0.1% quarter on quarter seasonally adjusted annual rate.
That's because everybody's using AI. We don't have to work as hard.
That's a disappointment.
Yeah, that's a disappointment. That number is correlated really well with GDP growth. So that is telling us that economic growth is slowing down. So we're at 1.5% in terms of GDP projections for Q2. We'll get the number pretty soon, actually. And then, what happens in the second quarter? We think that we're going to go into a downturn. And
you think second quarter growth is going to show 1%?
1.5%.
Which is kind of amazing because that feels like nothing or sounds like nothing, but it doesn't feel like nothing, right?
No, 1.5% is pretty good. I mean, the first quarter was 1.3% until all of a sudden it was 2, right?
Especially it's an annualized number as well. Yeah. So you just divide it by.
Steve, jump in here and tell us what your read on this report is with regards to the Federal Reserve that you cover so closely.
Well, the Feds will see this report as basically confirming their plans to hike in July. I mean, they had been pretty much set to hike, and there's nothing in this report that's going to change their mind. That you have, there are, as Yelena points out, there are some weaknesses in the report, but on balance, job creation is still running much higher than trend, much higher than the trend that they want to see. You see the unemployment rate going down. You see wages, average hourly earnings, rising, hours for this month rising. So it's there are lots of points where, the hawks can look at this and say, hey, this confirms our view of where the economy is. The goal of the Fed right now is to create below trend growth, and that would reduce pricing pressure, and they would like to see some small increase in the unemployment rate. That's not happening. This report is more consistent with very solid growth and a solid labor market. And so July, absent there being some shock in the consumer price index next week, July is set that they're gonna hike by a quarter point. And the real question is what happens in September and November and December. And, there's a lot of interest among the FOMC in hiking at least one more time beyond July.
I totally agree with Steve that July is right there. There's no question about that. And average hourly earnings growth totally supports that. the question is about what happens next. And I think this jobs report alleviates some pressure that they need to absolutely need to feel. They need to go in September and or November. So I think they
really?
I think they will
raise
stop.
Rates.
No, they will stop. They alleviates the pressure for them to do that.
Okay,
so I think that you know that July hike will be the last one. They will reach the terminal rate there, and by the time we get to the September and November meeting, there won't be any need to do more hikes.
No more talks of pausing. They'll just be done.
So yes.
One and done is your take. That's our forecast.
Steve, in a market environment and a world where I feel like we've been all over the map already here in 2023 in terms of interest rate expectations, you agree with Yelena?
I think that is a very reasonable take. And in fact, that Eric Rosengren, the former head of the Boston Fed, who was known as a hawk when he was at the Boston Fed, which was only, I guess, 2 years ago, he was saying one and done. So it's like, you know, there is definitely a segment of the Fed that will be on board with that. There are one or two people, including Rafael Bostic of the Atlanta Fed, who say no more hikes. So, you know, right now, there are pieces of the data that you can look at and say, you know, the economy is resilient, it's strong, you know, you're still seeing a lot of momentum. And then there are, as Yelena points out, there are some areas of weakness. So you're going to see some splintering between the hawks and the doves. It's been amazing that Chair Powell has been able to pull off, you know, this big increase in rates without there being any dissents in recent months. And, you know, you might start to see some splintering as you get near the end of this rate cycle.
And we kind of saw that in the minutes a little bit, right?
Absolutely, yes.
So maybe I think he's going to want to try and keep decisions unanimous, right? Even if they don't agree up until the point that he convinces them to agree for the sake of unanimity, which seems like,
well, we know there's cracks.
Kind of BS to me. But Yelena, let me ask you about the Economic Surprise Index. And we have obviously on the Bloomberg ECSU, but there are other Economic Surprise Indexes, and they're all, you know, sky high. I mean, if you take out, you know, the very beginning of the pandemic when we just started dumping trillions of dollars out of helicopters, we haven't seen the Economic Surprise Index this high since 2017. Is that going to turn around now? Is this the moment?
I think we may be seeing the moment, especially in the labor market. I think there are a lot of questions about how the data are reported, like in terms of seasonality and everything. So one thing we haven't talked about is seasonality of payrolls. We have seen significant support from seasonal factors in the first half of the year. But by definition, if seasonality pushes it up, it should push it down in the second half of the year. And I think we saw a turn in today's data as the seasonal factors are starting to subtract a little bit more. I think we will see more of that in July and in September. And I think we did see a turn in the labor market.
All right, so let's move forward to next week and the CPI report. Steve, how important, I know, you know, I feel like every Fed chief has their favorite inflation indicator. CPI isn't necessarily it, but it's still an important one, right?
CPI is very important. It's not the official target for the Fed, but it comes before the PCE index, and it's super, super important. And what's going to be interesting next week is the headline number is going to come down to maybe, if you look at the Bloomberg consensus, 3.1%. It could be, some have it as low as 3%. These are the lowest numbers in more than 2 years. The Fed's going to be focused on core inflation, excluding food and energy, and that has been sticky. The Fed has been very worried because core inflation has been very slow to come down in the first half of the year. So this is going to be key in terms of, are they going to finally see some progress on core inflation? But for, you know, for most Americans, the overall inflation is what matters. And if you get a number that's around 3%, that's getting really close to normal for most mm-hmm. people. And it's like wage gains have been in the area of 6% if you look at the Atlanta Fed's wage tracker. So people are starting to, with gas prices coming down, people are starting to get real wage gains. So it's like that should have some kind of impact on how people feel about,
right.
You know, confidence has been really bad of late.
And confidence is key, right? I mean, Yelena, how important is the consumer inflation expectation to what the Fed wants to do?
Well, it's crucial.
Yeah.
So, and if the Fed sees inflation expectations being contained, that will just help.
They were down when the U of M number came out, right?
Absolutely.
Out a year, 3%.
Yes. And gasoline prices could help if they go down a little bit from here. I think what we really, the crucial point here is the labor market. It's, you know, a little bit about inflation, a little bit about this and that, but what happens in the labor market is crucial. You have to keep those, you know, dollars coming
right,
in.
If you have a job,
if
you feel
don't have
confident.
A job, you know, that's it. You're not gonna continue spending, and things we will see will cut.
Well, they can't get. I mean, they can't get much better, right? So they can only get worse. But they have to get much worse to really make a difference. I mean, 3.6% unemployment.
You know, I'm just gonna say Barbie would already have it at 2% inflation.
Yep. You think?
No.
I don't know the Barbie story, but I
Steve Matthews, thank you. Thank you. Have a great weekend. Yelena Shalatyeva, so great to have you in studio again. This is Bloomberg Radio.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
Right now, though, we want to stay with the U.S. labor picture because the temporary help service payroll.
Well, yes. Should I just round up what we saw in terms of the numbers today? Because I think it was still a pretty amazing number. We had a change in non-farm payrolls. It was a gain of 209,000, which normally, you know, that's a big gain. We were looking for 230. That was the survey. And remember that we'd beaten in the last 14 months, the number beat the survey. So obviously people continue to up their numbers for the survey. And now we finally missed.
And the temporary help service payroll, though, declined again. It is considered as a leading indicator for the unemployment rate. So let's get some thoughts on that, because with us, back with us, is Richard Wahlquist. He's president and CEO of American Staffing Association, a trade association representing the American staffing industry. And he joins us on Zoom from Alexandria, Virginia. Richard, good to have you here with Matt and myself. So, remind us of your members and then what you guys are seeing when it comes to the U.S. labor market.
Sure. Hello, Carol. Hello, Matt. So our members are sourcing talent into every industry in the United States, including NGOs, and a big piece of the business for the industry is in the government sector. The industry literally sources talent into every occupation in the United States. And you're exactly right, Carol. People take a look at our industry because we are a leading employment indicator, which is to say that traditionally, and of course, every economic cycle is a little bit different, and this one's been very much different, but traditionally, temporary help is a leading indicator when the economy is beginning to heat back up again and employer confidence is picking back up again. We're a leading indicator as we see economic uncertainty. And so what we've been seeing over the past several months, very typical of this kind of a segment in the economic cycle, is employers have been dialing back on their use of flexible talent as a first-tier strategy, as they're kind of taking a good, hard look at what might be ahead. At the same time, we continue to hear reports that they are adding to their talent benches. And that reflects, I think, confidence in what's ahead, whether we've got a bit of a soft landing, a short and shallow recession. They're confident. They want to hang on to the talent that they've got.
Wait, so they're pulling back? I'm a little confused. They're holding on or they're pulling back?
They're pulling back on, so they're dialing back on that flexible outer ring of talent. So these are temporary and contract workers, and so they're dialing back on that. At the same time, we're talking to CEOs that say they still continue to get orders for full-time talent. I think that the job numbers reflect the fact that we've got job openings in America. The JOLTS numbers indicate we've got 1.6 job openings for every unemployed job seeker. But here's the other thing, Matt and Carol. Not everyone that's seeking a job has got the skills that employers currently need. So I'm hearing from our members that that talent is still a scarce commodity in terms of certain skill sets in certain industries.
Are you hearing that people are coming back in the labor force who had been sitting it out during the pandemic? Yelena Shalatyeva was just with us from BNP Paribas, and she was saying, women especially are starting to come back into the labor force now.
Women have actually been the winners, Matt, over the last couple of the BLS reports. We're seeing uptick in terms of number of women that are part of the labor force. Labor force participation rates are stagnant. I mean, they haven't really moved much in the last several months, and they continue to be well below the levels that we saw pre-pandemic, roughly running in the levels we saw in the 1970s. Fact of the matter is a lot of people have left the labor force. If we were running the same labor force participation rate as we were pre-pandemic, we'd have another 2 million workers in the labor force or actively seeking work. So yes, women have been a winner here. Employment amongst minorities, especially Black Americans, has ticked down a little bit.
Well, yeah, actually, you know, we had some stories that Black workers accounting for 90% of the recent U.S. unemployment jump. So, you know, once again, we're seeing as things maybe get changed a little bit, or we start to maybe potentially be at a transitional point, potentially maybe in the labor force, that once again, you know, some of the minority groups being hit the hardest. So, Richard, the reason we like talking with folks like you is you have these industry members, and so you get a good cross sampling of what's going on. So do your members talk a lot about recession? Just trying to figure out kind of where, as we had a soundbite from the head of Marathon Asset Management saying that, you know, you typically don't see the unemployment rate go up until after we are in a recession. So I'm just curious, are they talking about recession? Are they concerned about it? Just curious.
So the level of concern, always concern about a downturn that turns into an absolute recession, but the level of confidence in the state of the economy has gone up, I think, exponentially, Carol, over the last 18 months. People have been talking about that recession. It's going to happen 6 months from now, 6 months from now. But between labor markets and consumer spending, stubbornly, pieces of the economy just aren't cooperating with some of the forecasts. Back to labor force participation rate, I think what's most encouraging is that in the 25 to 54-year-old segment, considered to be prime workers, that labor force participation rate has actually gone up. But around the people that are on the sidelines, younger workers and older workers, way too many of them on the sidelines. And I think that it should be a priority for both the public sector and the private sector to find ways to bring these folks back in. Regarding minority employment.
Well, we had a great piece on the Bloomberg yesterday, the Bloomberg Big Take, I believe it was. And it was just talking about all the factories that are being built in the United States, but that the technical skills, you know, that there are workers that, you know, that they're going to be needed in those factories, but they're not going to have the technical skills to take on those jobs. And I'm just, is that part of what you guys are working on, or?
Absolutely, in a very big way. So the upskilling and the reskilling, the retraining of America has become a priority in most sectors. And our industry is working both with the clients and with government to find ways to make it really a reality. We've given lip service to lifelong learning for as long as we've been part of the labor force, but we have never seen so many changes within occupations. And the big change is now that employers are really focusing on skills, not so much job descriptions, not so much degrees that have long been associated with kind of entry-level requirements to get a foot in the door, really focusing on skills, and within the skill sets then going in and saying, look, we're going to have to do some upskilling here in terms of the impact that technology is having on, now we believe, you know, some 35% of jobs. It's going to impact some 65% of jobs over the next few years, and it's got to be an absolute priority.
All right, could I leave it on that note? Richard, have a good weekend. Richard Wahlquist, he is President and Chief Executive Officer of American Staffing Association on Zoom in Virginia. You know, Matt, you know, we'll see what happens. I feel like, you know, companies have been afraid to let go of workers, right? We've talked about worker hoarding and so on and so forth because they're worried about being able to replace those workers. But we'll see if things start to slow down.
Well, the interesting thing, I think, is hours worked, as Yelena Shulyeva pointed out. And when she did, I started digging a little bit deeper into it. It just hasn't expanded in the second quarter. And I made a little bit of a joke about AI kind of taking some of the productivity away. But that's what you're going to start seeing in probably the not too distant future.
You know, I'm also thinking about, I was at a store yesterday here in New York City, and I checked myself out, and it was a clothing retailer that I've never done that before, But it's just, I think you have more and more places that just can't find workers, and so they're automating stuff, right?
Or they want to do it that way, right?
Yeah, or they want to do it that way, exactly. And I thought that was pretty wild.
That is, what was the clothing store?
I'm not going to tell you.
Oh, come on.
I'm not going to tell you.
All right, well, maybe you'll tell me during the
But I actually had to take off the security sensor. Like, it was crazy.
That's nuts.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
All right, well, today J.P. Morgan out, doubting that a U.S. Bitcoin ETF would be a game changer. Matt, they noted that such funds have existed in Canada and Europe for years already, and that Bitcoin funds overall have attracted little investor interest. And yet...
Yes. Well, you know what? There were a ton of inflows to crypto ETFs last month. Over $500 million, which doesn't sound like that much, granted, but... there were outflows in the year before that. So it's turned around, even if it's not a titanic size yet.
All right. But they're saying that these things have been around overseas, Bitcoin
yes.
ETFs, and not a ton of flows.
Yes, exactly. I mean, it's not huge, but I'm just saying you can see a change in direction after BlackRock and others started filing ETF applications.
Which is what we want to talk about. We've got a great guest for our weekly look at the world of crypto. With us is Swan Bitcoin Managing Director Terrence Yang on Zoom from LA. Terrence, hey, nice to have you here with Matt and me. So what do you think of a Bitcoin ETF and moves by BlackRock and Fidelity and others when it comes to a spot Bitcoin ETF? ARK has definitely been out there for a long time on that.
So thanks for having me. Great to be here. I think that the JP Morgans of the world may be underestimating how bullish this is. Why? Because even though gold ETFs did not cause that big of a jump in the gold market cap when the gold ETFs arrived, and Bitcoin so the argument is the Bitcoin Grayscale Trust, right, GBTC, already has a big market cap. And so therefore, if you look at the gold ETFs and compare what BlackRock and Fidelity and Invesco are doing and others, that maybe there's not much room for Bitcoin to grow. I think that's incorrect. Why? Because gold has been around for thousands of years. It's globally accepted. By the time the gold ETF came out, for Bitcoin to have this kind of institutional support from the top TradFi players, BlackRock, Fidelity, Invesco, and others, is massive.
Yeah.
This comes, by the way, in the face of the SEC going back to back against Coinbase and Binance a month ago.
But not for Bitcoin, right? I mean, the SEC is after
Correct.
Those operators for what they consider to be securities. And I can imagine, I can see that point of view. Even if you argue they're commodities, you have to admit that they could look like securities, and a lot of them are just blatant securities. Bitcoin, however, the SEC has been very clear about it, is not a security. And I can't understand any reason they would have to fight against a Bitcoin ETF, unless they think that the price of the underlying commodity is being manipulated.
And that is the core of the issue. Bitcoin is a commodity. It does not meet the elements of the Howey test. It's decentralized. Even Larry Fink, who 5 years ago, the CEO of BlackRock, 5 years ago said Bitcoin was basically garbage, has now come around and said Bitcoin is digitizing gold and is a global commodity or global asset. On your point about the market manipulation, the SEC Division of Markets and Trading does need to get comfortable that the surveillance sharing agreements that BlackRock, Fidelity, and all the others, including ARK and Kathy Woods, all their ETF applications, new submissions, resubmissions, they all have these surveillance sharing agreements where they're looking at Coinbase, they're looking at NASDAQ to make sure that there's no price manipulation. Here's the question. Is the SEC going to approve this in light of the fact that Chinese exchanges, I hate to say it, including Binance, OKCoin, and Hobi, continue to do what looks like significant wash trading and price manipulation. We'll see. So I think it's an open question as to whether or not the spot Bitcoin ETF gets approved soon. It will eventually happen. But yeah, the key issue is the market manipulation.
Do you think, Terrence, that those organizations you just mentioned are actively manipulating the price of Bitcoin, you know, any more than some giant banks may actively manipulate the price of silver and gold?
Possibly more so, because even though, for example, JP Morgan has been caught manipulating certain precious metals and fined heavily, these are non-US entities that use a lot of tricks and ways to avoid.
We should point out that these are allegations. It's not, they're not uncommon. Conspiracy theory, I mean, that sort of paints it with a nasty brush.
Maybe conspiracy theory.
Yeah, but I'm just saying they're allegations, because we can't say that, yeah. You know, you can't make that kind of statement.
We don't know for sure, but if I were a betting man, and I am, I would bet a lot of money that the Chinese exchanges are manipulating the Bitcoin price. It's just very hard to prove, right? But if I had a bet, yeah.
But so Terrence, do you think this...
Now people were convicted and like, I mean...
Yes, yeah, for sure.
So, yeah.
You're talking about the JP Morgan and silver. Yeah. But in terms of the surveillance agreements, do you think that they're going to be... Is surveillance going to do much here? I mean, if we can't really pinpoint what's happening in terms of potential or alleged market manipulation, is Coinbase surveillance going to be able to do any better?
Especially since U.S.-China-Chinese relationships are so good right now.
Sarcasm.
Sorry. Yeah, a little sarcasm.
They can help, right? So the argument is that if you have a surveillance agreement, sharing agreement, with a big enough exchange, such as Coinbase, having significant market share of the Bitcoin market, maybe that's enough. I personally think the SEC they have an inconsistency, right, where they approve futures, U.S. futures, Bitcoin ETFs, but not spot, arguing that the futures Bitcoin prices were regulated on the CME and so forth. But at the end of the day, they all link back to Bitcoin, and the price, if it's manipulated in one sector, does impact another sector. So I think this can be short-term bullish until the market maybe figures out that a spot Bitcoin ETF may be a little bit further away than people think.
Can I ask your expectation for the price? I mean, I know it's a silly parlor game, but you did make a very good point. You did make a very good point, Terrence. You know, if all of the bullish money right now is already in GBTC, you know, then why would someone as massive, a behemoth like BlackRock, want to file for an ETF? They must think that 30,000 is not the limit.
That's one possibility, a very rational basis for doing so. Another possibility that I think is more probable is BlackRock and the others are betting on the fact, the non-zero chance, a significant risk that the SEC will lose, including on appeal, the litigation with Grayscale and GBTC, right? So Grayscale is suing the SEC, saying we want to be able to have a spot Bitcoin ETF. You should let us convert. And the SEC is saying no. So we'll see what the courts say. So if the courts rule in favor of Grayscale, that is going to open the floodgates for BlackRock and Fidelity and others to be like, hey, we're much more credible. We've been around longer than Grayscale and Barry Silbert and his shenanigans, allegedly. And we want our Bitcoin ETF, a spot ETF, approved as well. Why? Because they see opportunity. Why not file or refile?
Well, like you said about the credibility of something like a BlackRock or Fidelity, and just got about 30, 35 seconds, but I do think about those folks going down to DC with their deep pockets and lobbying efforts. I mean, and a lot more influence, correct?
Yes, a lot more influence. However, I don't expect a spot Bitcoin ETF to be approved for anybody, BlackRock or otherwise, By year end. But eventually, within 2 years, absolutely, it will be approved.
So just a timing issue.
In my opinion.
Hey, listen.
Yeah. Great. Yeah. Well, I was going to say, great to have you on the program, Terrence. And I hope you'll come on my Bloomberg Crypto show as well.
I'd love to. Thank you, Matt.
That is weekly, Tuesdays at 1 p.m. on Bloomberg Television.
Hashtag shameless plug.
Thank you.
But we love it. Terrence Yang, you are great. Managing Director at Swan Bitcoin, joining us on Zoom from Los Angeles, California. No, really smart conversation, right? And very specific in terms of what's going
on there.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Keep driving you crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
You drive me crazy.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, just under 18 minutes left in today's trading session, getting ready to wrap up the Friday trade as well as the holiday shortened trading week. And we've had equities kind of bouncing around here, and same thing for the Treasury trade coming off of that monthly jobs report. We've got a great market guest and looking forward to see what he has to say. And joining us right now, is Vance Howard. He's Chief Executive Officer and Portfolio Manager at the Registered Investment Advisor, Howard Capital Management on Zoom. It is a Friday on Zoom from Texas. Vance, good to have you back with us. And I should point out several of your funds, the Tactical Growth, 90th percentile over the past 3 years, the Income Plus Fund in the 98th percentile year to date, the HCM Dividend Sector Plus, 96th percentile in the past 5 years. So some really outstanding performance.
You're killing it.
We like to see performers. We like that. Real numbers. How's this environment? How do you describe it right now?
I think you've reached a new bull market. You know, the trend went higher in January. We're 100% invested now. I'm bullish, and I'm pretty optimistic about the outcome for the next two quarters of the year. You know, whenever you have the market up 10% or more in the first two quarters of the year, the odds are very, very high that the last two quarters will be higher, any from 8 to 10 to 12%. And there's a lot of reasons for this, but we're bullish. We're 100% invested. Now that we're invested, we're starting to rotate our money to different sectors that we think will outperform or different stocks. And we're very optimistic.
So, I mean, the S&P has already had a pretty killer year, right? Can it really get much better, or do you expect, the narrow breadth to simply broaden out?
I think the narrow breadth is going to start to broaden out. I mean, clearly it's been led by five or six stocks, but you can start to see that starting to broaden out now. And you look at, you know, breakouts like Visa and other, and, you know, Boise Cascade broke out in the construction area, and some of those stocks are looking very attractive to us. I think it's going to broaden out. I think there's $5.5 trillion of cash on the sidelines. You've got enough cash to fuel this thing much, much higher than what it is now. I think there's more cash on the sidelines than there were in 2008. And coming out of 2008, you almost had a decade-long bull market.
But let me ask you something, Vance. You know, when you've got a 10-year at 4.06, a 2-year at 4.9, so just below 5%, you know, that starts to look kind of interesting, you know, for an equity investor. And maybe without some of the, you know, problematic concerns about higher rates and what it does for asset valuation. So what's your argument, you know, fixed income versus the equity play?
Well, argument, I mean, I know we've got an inverted yield curve. I see it just like everybody else does. And we may end up having a mild recession. I don't know. Nobody can really predict that. Everybody's trying to game that right now. But you got to trade what's actually happening in the market. This is one of the biggest mistakes I think fund managers, investors make, is they want to predict instead of looking at what's happening right this minute, because that's all we know. Well, right this minute, the trend's up. You got to be in until the trend changes. You know, stick with that thesis, and I think you'll make a whole lot of money going forward.
So what's the best strategy? You run a number of different strategies, but what do you like right now? Are you looking for gains, capital appreciation here, or are you looking to conserve? Do you like dividends? What's most interesting to you?
Well, we don't have a lot of high dividend paying stocks or value stocks right now because they're just not working as well. They worked well last year in the nasty bear market, but right now you got to play with what's working, and that's mega cap, that's tech, and you got to stay right there until that changes. Some of the sectors that are working a little bit over the past handful of days, not that we own that much of energy, but again, trade what's working, do more of what's working, less of what's not. And mega caps work and tech's working. And, you know, everybody's always trying to find the next silver bullet here, but sometimes the obvious is where you need to be, and that's the obvious.
So why do you need to be in Monster Beverage right now?
You know, I like the little stock. I think that it did reasonably well. It's had a couple of acquisitions. I think it's a little bit of one of those stocks that appears to be broadening out. I like the technicals on it. And, you know, how long we own it, whether we own it a week, a year, you know, who knows? We'll see what happens with that talk.
But you own it now, right?
We have a little piece, yes.
So you like that? You like Visa? What was the other stock you mentioned?
Biogen.
You know, I really like Boise Cascade. Boise Cascade is a little company with, you know, the symbol's BCC, but it broke out of a nice 52-week high. And I love 52-week highs, guys. I love them. I love them. I love them. Let me tell you why. You cannot double your money without a stock breaking out to new 52-week highs all the time. So it's a pretty hard to do. But they're a construction company. They sell construction supplies. They've got a great balance sheet, well managed. I think construction is going to do well. Even if we had a recessionary environment, what happens with building materials? Well, people have to fix their own homes. They go out and buy different 2x4s and paint and caulk. And this is the kind of things that they sell.
So it's really interesting because, you know, we spend so much time talking about macro. It kind of makes me a little crazy because who the heck knows ultimately how it's going to play out. But what you're saying is look at the technicals, look at the fundamentals of some of these names. And I am curious, do you think this earnings season is potentially going to be something that can provide some momentum upside downside because we're going to start getting some more specifics on each of these companies?
That's a great question, too. And I think that the earnings came out really quite well over the past couple of months and past couple of quarters, and they do not seem to be slowing down. You know, you had a strong jobs market. So that means plenty of people have jobs out there. There's plenty of money being made, a lot of cash on the sidelines. I don't see that the interest rate being risen the way that it is affecting earnings at all. I think that these companies are making money hand over fist. And I think people need to really focus in on that. And I think they really need to try to stay away from the negative and look at the positive. Because if we are in a new bull market, the best gains are in the beginning phases of a new bull market.
Speaking of bulls, I got to ask you about cattle. We have seen a lot of, well, the hottest month on record in June, right? We've seen a lot of farmers rotate out of soy into corn. So feed is more expensive. The herds are smaller. And you have some cattle yourself, right? We've seen the prices just soar this year. Beef prices have. You have a take on that?
I do have a take. I just had 4 baby longhorns about 2 weeks ago. So I've got 4 baby longhorns on the ground right now. And cattle prices are doing well. Cattle, you know, it is hot here in Texas, but, you know, cattle do fine in hot weather. We're fine with that.
I was just wondering about, because we look at the price increases, not just for beef, but also for pork. It's done really well. Everybody's trying to switch over to chicken right now. They're a lot easier to raise. But I just think this is something that's getting a lot more attention than it typically does on Wall Street.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting question. Usually people don't ask me about the ranch, I could say.
That's why we love Matt. Hey, Vance, real quickly, I'm looking at your tactical growth fund. I get it. There's a lot of tech in there, the QQQs, NVIDIA, Meta. I mean, you're really all in on technology, aren't you?
And it's working. It's working this year. You know, we got our first buy signal in January, so we started moving back into the market. We were heavy into cash last year. You know, last year was a very challenging market to trade due to the volatility, and you know, we did our best to trade through it, did a fairly decent job. But when you look at the relative strength, you've got to go into tech, you've got to go into AMD. You know, I've been telling people to buy NVIDIA back when it was at 140 a share.
Yeah, Microsoft, Apple, these are all in that fund. Hey, listen, always fun to catch up with you and talk tech or talk cattle. It's always fun.
They own and operate the Bar C Ranch, is why I asked.
I know. Vance Howard of Howard Capital Management, be well, joining us on Zoom in Texas. This is Bloomberg Business Week.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.